Do you like a syllabus? Okay, so this is not a required course. And as you all know, for the graduate curriculum, so you're here to learn E&M, and there are some really interesting topics in the second half of this textbook, I think. Because it's a smallish class and we're under 10 registered, there's no grader except me. So I'll be grading your homework, possibly not in as much detail as you had graded last semester, but you can... I hope you'll look through my solutions and sort of see what if you can learn something from my solutions as well. And I'm, as I wrote, I'm not planning to have exams. So this is really just if I see some effort, some turning in homework, and then there's no worry about getting a passing grade in the course. Everyone will pass. So I'm just focused on the physics and relearning it myself. I haven't taught this for several years, so there's a lot of interesting stuff here that I need to relearn as I go. So be gentle if I stumble over some of the derivations. The first homework set is posted on the website. It's due 2 weeks from today. It's just a couple of problems. And I guess everyone here took my E&M 1. If you want a reminder of where we ended last semester, kind of in the middle of Chapter 7, the lecture notes, I did include in the lecture notes directory for this course last semester's notes as well. Okay, so the topic of frequency dispersion is basically thinking about frequency dependence of the wave vectors in monochromatic waves in a medium. And so this section 7.5, basically we're looking at describing epsilon of omega. We're talking about linear dielectric media. We've talked about, right, D is epsilon E. And now we view these, everything in that equation, as at one frequency. Okay, so thinking of monochromatic waves. In practice, they won't be exactly monochromatic, of course. They'll have some range of frequencies that we know because the frequency time uncertainty principle, every wave has to have some temporal structure to it. And that implies it won't have an exact single frequency. But to kind of get the big picture, it's useful to introduce a classical model for this. I'm going to start with that, and then I'll derive a quantum treatment, basically at the level you would learn in your quantum course, probably. So this is part A in the notes, and we're going to do this classical model. For the frequency-dependent dielectric constant. And we will assume a low-density material, like a gas, for instance. Low-dense. And I'm not going to focus on the magnetic properties. Let's just assume the magnetic susceptibility is mu naught, the vacuum value, and we're going to use this classical model, which is about all people had in the days before quantum mechanics, when you think these kind of ideas were being developed in the maybe late 1800s, early 1900s. We'll imagine each electron in the material is bound as a harmonic oscillator. Some characteristic oscillator frequency, omega naught, and we're going to subject this material to a monochromatic electric field. We'll have some possibly complex amplitude E naught and a monochromatic time dependence e to the minus I omega t. And of course we know we would actually in a medium we would have also an e to the I k dot x going along with that that would solve Maxwell's equations, but we're going to imagine that this is approximately constant over the distance scales we're looking at, and so I'm not going to include that in the discussion. Okay, so we'll just do F equals ma, mass of the electrons times acceleration, include a phenomenological damping term with damping constant gamma times velocity, and the oscillating potential force term, I should say, and equate that to the force on the electron minus E naught e to the minus I omega t. And what we're going to do is, as you know, there could be, in an inhomogeneous equation like this, there could be transient terms, but we're just going to look at the steady state solutions at the driving frequency. So what that means is, omega. Is that we're making this ansatz for the solution that x of t has some amplitude and it has the same time dependence, e to the minus I omega t, and we'll plug this in to the equation and we'll get an equation for x naught. The math is very simple here, minus omega squared minus I gamma omega plus omega naught squared, x naught is minus E naught e to the minus I omega t, and so these cancel out time dependence. And we're left with the time-independent amplitude, x naught, that's minus E over M, 1 over omega naught squared minus omega squared minus I omega gamma, E naught. And from this, we can calculate the induced electric dipole moment. So I'll come back over here. The displacement, which is E squared over the mass, this denominator, times the driving electric field. So we're kind of thinking every electron in the medium is behaving like this classical damped oscillator at this characteristic frequency omega naught. And again, we'll link this picture to the quantum, more modern ideas about what is actually happening in the medium later. So to try to take this to a macroscopic level now, with really seeing how the whole gas is behaving, we'll now suppose we have some density of molecules in this volume. We'll call this density capital N, as our favorite textbook declares, capital N molecules per unit volume. And let's say each has Z electrons. In general, these might have, yeah. Well, E is time dependent. That's where the time dependence is. Everything, basically everything here has that same monochromatic time dependence. Okay, so yeah, we have the Z electrons, each with frequencies. Allow them to have different frequencies, omega J. And if we say the fraction of electrons of the jth type of electron with frequency omega j is f sub j, then more or less we're going to say that the sum over j of all these fj would be this number of electrons in one molecule. Don't take this too seriously, because again, this is not the quantum picture, which is reality. But this is how people tried to kind of make sense of dispersion before quantum mechanics was there. And it does give some insight into the whole phenomenon. We also need the polarization of the material, which you'll remember from last semester, capital P is the density times the individual dipoles. And so here, the medium polarization is Ne squared over M, sum over J, over the fraction in oscillator J, j squared minus I omega gamma j times E. And if you remember, we call this epsilon naught chi E times the electric field, where chi E is the electric susceptibility. And so essentially we have a model for the dielectric constant in the medium, namely epsilon naught of omega over epsilon naught plus 1, is 1 plus chi e, is 1 plus n e squared over epsilon naught m, sum over j, fj over omega j squared minus omega squared minus I omega gamma j. And that's our key model result from this oscillator model in the medium. Interestingly, we will see the quantum model ends up giving a very similar looking formula. And actually, Heisenberg, when he was developing quantum mechanics, he used these kind of ideas connecting some of these sorts of simplest models of light absorption from these pictures to, in his rather counterintuitive way, that he quote-unquote derived or guessed, depending on your point of view, quantum mechanics. Okay, so that's classical physics, but let's get a little closer to reality and think about the quantum derivation. I think most of you have seen first-order time-dependent perturbation theory, which is all the quantum mechanics I'm going to use here. And if that's a little rusty, you might review the first page of that in your favorite text. There's a couple of references I could mention. There is a book by Fano, my thesis advisor, and his former student Rao, called Atomic Collisions and Spectra, which has the derivation and discussion more or less I'm going to present in the early first or second chapter of the book, I think. If you don't have that access to that book, you can also find a lot of these ideas in a 1968 Review of Modern Physics article by Fano and Cooper. Very heavily cited paper about how light is absorbed throughout the whole frequency domain in the periodic system. That would be section two of that paper. Okay, so let's come back to talk about the field first. It'll say we have an applied electric field. It's going to go into the Schrodinger equation, time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And we'll write it this way. I'll pick it linearly polarized along the x-axis, some overall amplitude E naught, and have our e to the minus I omega t, which, as we know, always implies the conjugate will be there in the true electric field. And so the potential energy, if you remember, it's not the field that goes into the Schrodinger equation normally, it's the potential energy of the particles minus Ex E naught to the minus I omega t plus e to the I omega t. And now we'll do first order time-dependent perturbation theory, which is really just a very simple indefinite integral over time of the potential. If you expand the wave function in the, well, let me write that. The idea of first order perturbation theory is, let's say you have all ground state atoms or molecules in the gas initially. Now you're going to apply the field, and you're going to add, that's going to cause extra terms to appear. It's going to change the wave function. And if it's a small perturbation, like small electric field, like in a normal light wave, you can write this extra term as a sum over all the energy eigenstates, the excited states of the Schrodinger equation. So we'll call the jth eigenstate psi j. It has this time dependence. Psi j here is just the spatial part. This e to the minus I e j t over h bar is its time dependence of the jth stationary state. And now introduce some unknown constants. In principle, if you sum over all states, this could be exact, this description, if you solve exactly for the Cj of t. but we're going to solve them in perturbation theory. So let me just write that formula. I'm not going to rederive or give you all the equations of first order time dependent perturbation theory. You can look that up in your quantum book if it's a little rusty. But not surprisingly, the Cj of t will be proportional to E naught. So let's write it out. It's a very simple integral of an exponential you have to do. And you get Cj of t is E naught over h bar psi j. Spatial matrix element of the x coordinate that's in the potential energy, right. And then the matrix element to the ground state, spatial ground state, and then there's this time-dependent integral is just exponentials divided by frequencies. This gets added to, so that's basically coming from the e to the I omega t term, and then there's another coming from the e to the minus I omega t term in the perturbation. One thing that we've kind of added here ad hoc, although it's really in the physics, is this gamma j. So right, these omega j's, quantum mechanically, right, these are the energy difference between the excited energy eigenvalue and the ground state over h bar. Except if you have the energy levels of the atom or molecule, right, and these have some decay constant, every state that's not the ground state will decay at some rate. We can represent that by a complex energy epsilon j minus I gamma j over 2. So we include an imaginary part in the energy of those excited states, kind of phenomenologically. One reason to do that is this helps you to not have this diverge to infinity when you're exactly on resonance. And as I said, every state is really does have that natural line width. Or either due to its radiative decay or due to other decay processes. Okay, so from this now we have enough information to calculate the electric dipole moment of the molecule. Basically, just take the expectation value of the charge times the position. I won't write a vector on this because we know it'll be in the x direction. So let's just calculate this expectation value of the position operator in x. So I can write these matrix elements in an abbreviated notation like that for the spatial matrix elements. Cj of t minus I omega j minus I gamma j over 2t plus the complex conjugate e to the I omega j plus I gamma j over 2 times t jx0. Now we'll plug in the CJs, get E squared E naught over H bar. So we're going to get a dipole moment proportional to the applied field strength, of course. And we just have this matrix element, since this and its conjugate are equal. And just factor those out and get the I omega t over this now denominator with frequency squared units, omega j squared minus omega squared plus I omega gamma j plus e to the minus I omega t for omega j squared minus omega squared minus I gamma j omega. And there is an, So this is what we will equate to E naught, a polarizability. Right. Dipole moment is polarizability times electric field. And that same time dependence, e to the minus I omega t plus the conjugate, e naught alpha conjugate of omega, e to the I omega t. And then to get the units right, we need to tack on an epsilon naught. That's a little bit of a tricky point. Jackson, I think, is actually very inconsistent in his inclusion of epsilon naught in the polarizability formulas. So you might want to rely on some other texts like Wikipedia when it comes down to that, or just go to Gaussian units where it's much simpler and there are no epsilon naughts floating around to mess up. But finally, we have then, we can extract by equating these two equations, we can extract the formula for the polarizability in the quantum treatment. And this really works. I've calculated polarizabilities myself, at least for atoms, using formulas like this. This is pretty much reality. But it's frequency dependent now. It's E squared over M. And we can write it in a form that's kind of analogous to the classical model form, which I will do. I'll just recast that expression in this notation, Fj over omega j squared minus omega squared minus I gamma j Oh my God. This by itself would have units of volume. And when you look up polarizability in tables of media, pick your, or on the internet, you'll usually find this number quoted that has volume units, right, meter cubed in SI units. But for E&M purposes, in SI units, there will be a 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, and I think Jackson does not have the 1 over 4 pi, but I believe that is the correct SI expression. But finally, then, this Fj, which was just a phenomenological fraction in the classical model, now we have a quantum formula for it. Twice the electron mass, the jth frequency of excitation, E minus Ej, sorry, Ej minus E ground, I mean, over H bar, and then the spatial matrix element of X between the excited and the ground state absolute square. This is a dimensionless number, which is sometimes called the oscillator strength. Partly because of its analogy to the Fj that appeared in the classical derivation. And there are some nice properties of this. You can actually prove in non-relativistic quantum mechanics that the sum over all the excited states of this Fj, this oscillator strength, is in fact the charge per molecule in the system, which is sometimes called the Thomas Reich Kuhn sum rule. It's pretty easy to prove this. When I teach quantum, I usually assign that as a homework problem. It's also proven in Fano-Cooper, I believe, or it's at least quoted there. Okay, so those are the classical model and this quantum treatment that puts basically the structure of that classical formula on a more rigorous foundation, using quantum mechanics. Now we can start talking about electromagnetic phenomena implied by these relationships involving the dispersion. Takes us to topic B for the day, which is anomalous dispersion. I guess you know a lot about anomalous dispersion already. Okay, let me remind you from chapter 4 last semester, we derived a relation between the electric susceptibility and the polarizability using the Clausius-Mossotti equation. We got something like this, alpha n over 1 minus a third alpha n. And for low densities, and basically we can neglect this term in the denominator and just say that it's usually for the kind of ordinary size polarizabilities and densities, modest densities. This we can just write it as proportional to alpha n. Now, usually in these systems, the damping constants, the decay of these excited states by radiation, these are much, much less than omega j. Remember, like for electronic excitations in the, like the visible or ultraviolet, we're seeing frequencies 10 to the 14 or 10 to the 15 radians per second. And the decay constants are usually no faster than nanoseconds. So you've got about six orders of magnitude usually different between the decay constants and the actual frequencies at the of the resonant frequencies. Okay. So let's first of all neglect this damping for the most part. In these formulas, it'll only be important if you drive very close to resonance, one of the resonant frequencies in these denominators. Then, of course, it starts to become important. And so let's look at two limits. Let's start with the low frequency limit and think about what is the physics in this expression. So epsilon of omega over epsilon naught approaches, as omega goes to very small frequencies, much less than any of these omega j's, characteristic frequencies from the ground state to the excited state. There will be the one, and then the smallish linear correction term we've derived, e squared n over epsilon naught m. And then there is the sum over all the excited states, j greater than zero, the oscillator strength divided by omega j squared. It's the dominant. If you take the omega equals zero limit of this. Right. I guess I'm leaving out the 4 pi. So here I'm using Jackson's notation. Now, what can happen is if there is an omega naught term in our sum, then we should add an extra term here. This is a slightly subtle point. One way to think of this, having a zero frequency resonant term in our model, is you can think that this means there are free electrons present, like in a conductor. Right, you can just apply a field, a static field, and they will move through the conductor. That's kind of modeled in this picture as just an omega naught equals zero term. So there we can't just neglect all these omega terms compared to omega naught, and we have to add an extra term, I e squared n over epsilon naught times mass, some oscillator strength, I'll call it F naught, divided by our denominator over there for omega naught equals zero, which looks then like omega times gamma naught minus I omega. So I want to discuss a little bit the presence of this term. Actually, in the next few equations, or something I added today, and they're not in the lecture notes online, so this might be a place to take notes if you want to keep track of these, the next ideas. So let's remember the Ampere-Faraday equation, curl of H is not just J, but it's also the time derivative of the displacement. Okay. Now, also remember, in an ohmic conductor, J, right, whenever you see that, you should think J is sigma E, where sigma is the conductivity. So that in a linear medium, we could also write then that the curl of H is minus I omega, now specializing to monochromatic fields and sources, minus I omega times the dielectric constant that is in D, right? D is epsilon E. I'll call it epsilon B, which is Jackson's notation in this discussion. But now we can, it gets combined with the conductivity. Times E. And what this equation shows is that this conductivity role, you could put it in explicitly the way it's written here, or you could regard it as the imaginary part of the dielectric constant. And basically, you could say that that polarizability, I'm sorry, the conductivity physics, you can also say it's already represented here in this part of our dielectric constant derivation. If you do that, then this says that in our model that we're talking about, the conductivity then would be expressed as F naught Ne squared over the mass times gamma naught minus I omega. Okay. And again, that's just for a conductor where there are free electrons that will respond like to a static field. So this is the low frequency behavior. Let's do the high frequency behavior. But one thing I should stress is you should not try to both include the imaginary part of the dielectric constant as causing the conductivity and the conductivity itself. I think we talked about that maybe in chapter 6, that like in some energy expressions, there was a conductivity if it was present, but you could also count that through the imaginary parts of the dielectric constant, but you shouldn't include both. Okay, let's look at the high frequency limit. if you want to think sort of realistic frequency range, you know, maybe you're thinking here either static field limit or microwaves, some radio waves, very, very slowly oscillating fields. Now we're thinking more about visible to X-ray radiation. In the high frequency limit, where we'll go to that limit, this omega is much greater than all the relevant omega j's. Actually, of course, some of the omega j's in a real atom or molecule go to infinity. So, but at some point, they will have no appreciable oscillator strength. So in this limit, you go to 1 minus Ne squared z over m epsilon naught omega squared, which is often rewritten as 1 minus a characteristic squared frequency omega p, where omega p is the square root of n ze squared over epsilon naught m is called the plasma frequency of the material. So those are two important limits. A third that's important is if you are near a resonant frequency. This is where mostly quantum optics lives. You're shining in a laser very close to the resonant frequency of the atom or molecule to excite a specific transition from the ground state to one particular excited energy level. Guess I don't need this anymore. So if I go to omega close to this resonant frequency, omega j, then the infinite sum, which I no longer have on the board, collapses to a single term that is dominant. And the polarizability will be, to a good approximation, just e squared over m, the oscillator strength associated with that energy level, Fj over omega j squared minus omega squared minus I gamma j omega. So this, in this form, you don't see very clearly the real and imaginary parts separated out, which are playing a different role. So let's separate them out. In a lot of chapter 7, the interest is in separately understanding these roles of the real and the imaginary parts of the dielectric function or of the polarizability. In this case, the real part of alpha of omega. And let's see, I apologize. In these formulas, I've left off my epsilon naught. So this is just the volume part of the polarizability, if you want to say it that way, which is what you'll find in tables if you look up the polarizability. But if you're doing lots of calculations in SI units, which I usually avoid in this field, you'll have to keep track of your epsilon naughts. Squared over m, fj. And now I'm assuming the fj's here are real and that the only imaginary term is coming from this. So it's easy to get the real and imaginary parts, right? You multiply by omega j squared minus omega squared plus I gamma j omega over the same thing. And then you can read off the real and imaginary parts. You have a, omega j squared minus omega squared over omega j squared minus omega squared squared plus gamma j squared omega squared. There's the real part of the polarizability and the imaginary part in this formulation or model or our quantum treatment, whichever you want to be thinking about, is not surprisingly proportional to an overall factor of gamma j, so it would vanish if there's no decay. Then divided by the same energy denominator, omega j squared minus omega squared squared plus gamma j squared omega squared. And these are two of the main results of this whole section. So let me make some plots to talk a little bit about what's going on here, what this means. And don't forget, these are things you can measure in the medium and see what they look like. Shine in a laser, see the losses, see the refraction. So if I plot either the real or imaginary part of epsilon of omega over epsilon naught, then as a function of omega, and I look near a resonant frequency, the imaginary part usually looks something like this. It has a simple Lorentzian type peak, which is symmetric, centered on the resonant frequency. So this is the imaginary part. The real part starts up here at 1, if you remember. And it's pretty flat until I come to the vicinity of this resonance. And now you can see that there is going to be a point where this numerator is actually 0. So, in fact, you get something you can think of as constructive and destructive interference that makes the real part look like that. Now, in a sort of normal material, at sort of visible-ish kinds of frequencies, you normally expect the energy derivative, or frequency derivative, to be positive, as it is here. But a characteristic thing about this physics is there is a region near any resonance where it has a negative derivative. In this region, it's sometimes called anomalous dispersion. Because this is not the usual behavior when you're away from a resonance. And it's anomalous because d by d omega of the real part of epsilon of omega is negative in this region. So this is a characteristic property that you see in the real world. And of course, what you're often interested in is how much loss is there. You send a laser beam into a gas or a solid, it's going to be attenuated. And this is, of course, what's controlling the actual attenuation of the beam, this imaginary part. There is a section I won't really talk about, but I encourage you to read on your own, 7.5 subsection E on pages 314 to 316, which has a graph of the water dielectric constant over a very broad frequency range. And water has something that's called the water window, which is kind of interesting, where basically water vapor has no absorption over some frequency range, which is something like a frequency nu 410 to the 14 hertz to 810 to the 14 hertz, which is in fact in the visible region. It's probably no coincidence that that's where our eyes work. In seeing stuff through the atmosphere that does have water vapor in it. Okay, so ready for the next topic. One of the things we are building toward, which I guess I won't get to until next time, is the Kramers-Kronig relations, which are a beautiful theory that relates these two. So like if you measure the imaginary part of the dielectric constant at all frequencies, it tells you that theory, the Kramers-Kronig theory, or dispersion relations, they tell you the real part is fixed once you know the imaginary part. It's kind of amazing, amazing theory. But we have one more preliminary before we get to that, which is, where are we? We're still in section 7.5, I guess. But we're going to talk about now what are some of the implications of this dispersion for how light goes through a medium. So, interesting phenomena. As I've tried to stress, this monochromatic limit we've been talking about is a mathematical case. It's easy to work out, but it's not fully realistic, because really any true electromagnetic wave is going to have some range of frequencies. And this brings us to the ideas of dispersion and the Y group velocity is important to understand. Okay, so a monochromatic plane wave, which has this structure, u to the ik dot x minus omega t, this mathematically extends over all positions and all times. Okay. And any real electromagnetic wave will have a finite extent and duration, and so we will need to superpose frequencies and in general wave numbers. Wave vectors, really. have to now keep track of the fact that epsilon is complex. How does the complex nature of epsilon of omega affect all that? Okay, so here are the sort of physical implications that we'll work out mathematically in a minute. Physical implications. One is that the phase velocity of such a wave depends on omega. Phase velocity, I guess I might as well go ahead and define it now, although I was going to later, is omega of k over k. It's the ratio of the, it's how fast this phase is actually advancing. And that's frequency dependent, and it's often written in a different way. Instead of as k of omega, it's written as omega of k. And for this discussion, I'm going to, let me just say that. The fact that this phase velocity depends on omega, or that omega depends on k, means that the different frequency components they were all locked in phase in some like envelope function of a wave packet at one time or one frequency, you would see they are getting out of phase either as time evolves or if you look at different frequencies. We'll see mathematically what I'm talking about there in a minute. Second key point about this dispersion is that we'll see that energy flows not at this speed of the phase velocity, but at the speed of the group velocity. The phase velocity is actually the speed of light divided by n, the index of refraction. But the relevant velocity is instead going to be the group velocity that we'll derive shortly. And then the third point about this is that when the imaginary part of epsilon is non-zero, which means always just about, there will be dissipation. Okay, so that brings us to the math, which is now actually section 7.8 of Jackson. Let's work this out and see these implications coming out of the math. And to do that, we're going to focus on the wave equation in one spatial dimension. Squared minus 1 over v squared d squared dt squared u of xt zero is basic structure for any type of waves that we've talked about, not just electromagnetic waves in general. We know this has monochromatic plane wave solutions. Some amplitude constant times e to the I kx minus omega t, where omega is k times the velocity. Or another way to say that is omega of k, as I wrote over there, over k is the k-dependent velocity of the wave. And now I'm going to assume, for the time being, I'm going to assume this is real, or omega of k and k and velocity. So we're ignoring dissipation. Okay. So let's make a general wave packet solution by Fourier analysis. U of x t, and now, I guess I should have turned off this light. Not sure why that didn't turn off. Over root 2 pi, integral minus infinity to infinity, some amplitude, A of k times e to the I kx minus I omega of k t integrated over k. Can represent any solution of our wave equation that way. This is analogous to the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, right? In there, which is a first-order time derivative. If you know psi at one time, the time-dependent Schrodinger equation tells you psi at all later times. Here we have a second-order equation. So you need more information to propagate a wave packet and find its general evolution at all later times. Basically, you need to be given, if you wanted to say, take an initial solution and then find it at later times, you'd have to get u of x at time zero, which of course would be 1/2, 1 over root 2 pi, integral of a of k e to the I kx dk plus the complex conjugate. But you would also need the first time derivative, all right, as u sub t means partial u with respect to t. You would need this. That would pull down, the derivative would pull down an omega of k. K e to the I kx dk plus complex conjugate. So you'd need to take your initial wave if someone handed it to you, and you'd need that and the time derivative. And then you could do Fourier's trick, meaning you multiply by e to the minus ik prime x, you integrate, and you'll figure out the a of k I gave a few details of that in the notes. Basically, you'll have to do that on both of these, and the the Fourier trick will be involve two solutions and two unknowns for A of k and A conjugate of k. So let me skip some of that algebra and just write the solution from that Fourier's trick analysis, inverting these Fourier series, so that if we were given the initial wave and its time derivative, then A of k would be this integral e to the minus ikx u of x0 plus I over omega of k first time derivative u of x0 integrated over x. Okay. So these waves obey, of course, an uncertainty relation both in time and in space, as we expect, because they both are coming from Fourier analysis, Fourier variables. So for instance, if I plot a wave packet in space, when I say wave packet, I usually mean some kind of localized structure, localized with some characteristic spread in X, and that will translate into a spread in K space. Some corresponding delta K. And we expect from the theorems of Fourier analysis, delta K, delta X should be greater than or about a number of a half, and with equality only for a Gaussian amplitude pulse. But now to go farther, we want to usually consider an A of K that is kind of localized around some k-naught value. So in other words, let's Taylor expand our omega of k function, which is characterizing our dispersion in the neighborhood of k naught. There would be a linear term d omega dk at k naught times k minus k naught. And there will be a second derivative term d squared omega k squared k naught times k minus k naught squared. Usually we stop our Taylor series there. And then what I'll do next time is I'll pick a detailed model for you of X as our initial wave packet, which is a Gaussian times a cosine of k naught x, and we'll neglect ut of x0. And we'll work this out, and we'll see where group velocity emerges and how that, what that tells us about what happens to this wave going through. I think I'll maybe even show a video next time of light going through a Coke bottle. There's a really great TED Talk about that. You can actually see the light pulse going through a Coke bottle that's it's filled with water. I don't think Coke. Okay, see you next time.